Excited to lap up another episode of Gravy? Tell a friend.
Pass the gravy boat. There's plenty to go around.
I'm Melissa Hall.
And I'm John T. Edge.
We're your hosts for Gravy.
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 In this season of Gravy, the Southern Foodways Alliance explores the Alabama Black Belt.
Ever since James Agee and Walker Evans traveled Hale County, Alabama, to research the magazine article that became the book Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, outsiders have documented and pathologized the region.
Gravy aims to change that narrative by offering a series of episodes conceived and reported by people who live and work in Alabama.
Today's episode focuses on the very resource that put the Black Belt on the map, fertile farmland. Emily Blavoz reported the heck out of this one.
Alabama's Black Belt stretches in a strip roughly 25 miles wide across the center of the state and includes a quarter of Alabama's counties. Named for the rich soil that enabled cotton to flourish, the Black Belt was once the most prosperous and politically powerful region of the state. It held most of the state's enslaved people, and African Americans still comprise the majority of the Black Belt population today. In the 20th century, Black Belt soil was depleted by overuse. A massive part of the Black population left in the Great Migration, and small farms decreased sharply beginning in the 1950s, reflecting a statewide pattern. Black Belt land transformed from family farms to commercial timber, hunting preserves, and wild acreage owned by families with new lives in other places. But lately, younger generations are returning to family land in the Black Belt. Andrew Williams, founder of the Deep South Food Alliance in Linden, Alabama, explains.
They remember the struggle that was there, you know, with their ancestors in acquiring the land. So today, people are more conscious of this land that granddaddy or great-granddaddy and them acquired, you know, and left to us. In many cases, now a lot of them have, you know, gone off and, you know, got education and had good jobs and what have you. And now they are coming back trying to preserve their legacy.
Andrew has made it his life's work to help small landowners in the Black Belt who are mostly African American. He has watched older generations leave, shunning agricultural life and the trauma of slavery and sharecropping it represents. And he has seen younger generations return, exploring farming as a source of healing, renewal, and stewardship. He begins with his own story.
I'm from Marengo County, Alabama, and that's in the midst of the western part of the Alabama Black Belt. I was born in the Black Belt. Matter of fact, I was born across the road from where I live now. I was brought into the world by a midwife.
Andrew's childhood was shaped by a neighborhood school teacher, Ms. Salome Bennett.
I went home with her and she cleaned me up, got me some new clothes, and my first meal at her house, it was a moon pie and a new grape soda in the bottle. You had to take a little tool and, you know, take the top off the soda. And so I hit that moon pie a couple of times and took a couple of swigs out of that new grape soda. Hey, I have arrived. But she taught me about giving back.
Ms. Bennett often helped local families with groceries and other needs.
She knew the power of education. She knew the power of hope.
On this foundation, Andrew built a career at the Natural Resources Conservation Service, an agency within the USDA, where he strived to help underserved landowners. This was no easy feat, because the system was designed to capture progress in big pieces. For that reason, large landowners, who were more often white, tended to receive assistance before small landowners, who were more often black. Andrew pushed for changes to better serve small landowners, and even when his superiors were dismissive.
I didn't lose hope. I kept putting that on the table. And they did allow me, as a part of my work, is to venture out and see what else was out there. in terms of programs and practices that would fit these smaller scale folks. And I would take that back to the management table and say, you know, we need to consider some of these practices in our program. Well, why we need to do that? Because this will work for smaller producers, wherein some of the other programs weren't. So it was about the system, and it was about petitioning the system to evolve so you could serve better.
In 2009, Andrew retired from the NRCS and founded the Deep South Food Alliance to help small landowners in the Black Belt, which he insists must be done on a case-by-case basis and always begins with hearing the story of the land.
Sometimes you can carry your smart self out there on the land and start telling the land and the landowner what you need to do based on research I've done and based on what I've learned when I was in Colorado and all that. If you go with your own ideas and your own concept, it's a very good possibility that you will miss the target. We use the approach is, okay, let's hear the story first. Let's see what the story is. You know, what's on your mind about this land? And then what it is that you want to do. And based on that story, then we walk the land and the land began to speak back to us based on the story. And if you can make that connection, that spiritual connection, then you're ready to help them.
Andrew describes what he discovers while walking and listening.
If you go out and they say, well, all of these fields used to be cornfields, and that means the soil type on this field is a certain type. It's good drainage, you know, because they was farming it. You know, if it's down in the lowland, you know, that was used for something else. So the land is speaking to you then. There's certain vegetation that grow on upland land. There's certain vegetation that grow on wetland land. You know, it used to be a spring right here. It used to be a shade tree here or whatever. So you have to be astute enough to process that information, because that's good information. That's historical information. And if you're not attuned to African-American landowner, you're not attuned to that, you'll miss that.
In the Black Belt today, family land is often heir property, land that has been passed down through the generations and divided between many family members, which complicates decision-making and usually results in the land reverting to wilderness. Andrew helps returning landowners tap into federal and state programs for timber management and conservation, and also helps those interested in growing food.
If they are farming their row cropping and what have you, and they be the soil, topsoil may be washing away. Okay, what are the practices that I can apply to this land that I'm farming that will enable my soil health to be better on this land? Can I plant cover crops? Can I farm on the contour? You know, can I put more organic back into the soil? And one of the things that they were saying is, produce farmer was saying, we need a place where we that can serve as a clearinghouse or aggregation center where we could bring products and sell them.
So Andrew and his staff set up such a center, but volume proved a challenge. They had to source produce from far outside the Black Belt to meet local demand.
And then the other thing is that we was hearing a lot of hype, I called it, about farm to school and growing locally and all of that. And so we began to petition the local school districts, and we started selling them purple whole peas and chopped up collard greens and that kind of thing. And
the arrangement worked well for a while, but then the school system stopped calling. They had started buying produce from a large corporate distributor for half the price.
So those are some of the obstacles that's real out here. And what killed me more than anything, it's all about hype. You know, you hear stuff and, you know, people want to do this and that. And then when you go out and do it, it's a whole different story. It make you want to holler.
So we asked, how do you get past the hype and design something that enables small landowners to make a living off their land?
We should be able to communicate with each other that if we bought locally, that would make an impact. But I'm afraid that when we meet on Sunday morning, we don't talk about economic development. We talk about going over yonder where you wear the golden slippers. And I'm not down on that because I attend church regularly. As a matter of fact, I'm a deacon on the board, whatever. So we got to begin to think about what it is that we have in our hand. And the major impact can be done by people. Everybody that meets on Sunday morning, everybody that meets at the club on Saturday night, everybody got to be on the same page. We not a lost cause. We not a lost people.
Also, Andrew says, communities need to identify real leaders.
A lot of time we think that community leader is that shiny suit preacher that shows up on Sunday morning, or that politician that talks really good when it's election time. But you gotta look at people and see who head have risen above the circumstances, and that's your leader. In many cases, that leader is that single mom that have survived. Most of the time in the black community, they are females in most cases, you know, because they're strong, and they always been. Black females always been strong and fairly free.
After the break, we hear from one of these leaders, a leader who has always been strong and decided to be free. Travel with Jackie Clay to Cuba, Alabama.
Maker's Mark Bourbon is aged to taste in Loretto, Kentucky. The Samuels family uses locally grown soft red winter wheat and sources water from a lake on the distillery's campus. Every Maker's Mark label is printed and die-cut by hand on an antique press, and each bottle is hand-dipped in their signature red wax. All the details matter when distilling quality bourbon. Since Maker's Mark sold its first case of bourbon to the Keeneland Racecourse in Lexington, they have perfected the craft of distilling American whiskey. For their dedication to making great bourbon and for their support of the Southern Foodways Alliance, we thank them. Maker's Mark crafts their bourbon carefully. Please enjoy it that way.
Yawa Awalawo, a vegan chef, runs Mahala Farm on her family's land in the Black Belt.
Greetings. I am Yawa Awalawo from Cuba, Alabama. I was born here. I'm a mother of nine, and I have 30 grandchildren and one great-grandchild. My mother is still alive. She is 97 years old. She also was raised on this land, and she have beautiful stories that sometimes she can tell in funny stories.
Yawa and her siblings were raised mostly by their great-aunt Mahala, while their mother worked in Knoxville, Tennessee, and sent money home to Alabama. Yawa describes the farm, typical of a family farm in the Black Belt in the 1950s and 60s.
We had corn, cotton, orchards, cows, hogs, chickens, mule, and horses. So we were what you call self-sustaining. We drew our water from the well. We had a spring, and we had creeks where we watered the animals. We had our own cow, so we had our own milk, made buttermilk and our butter. We made our own molasses, and we also used the molasses as sweetener. Every once in a while, my uncle used to rob honey from the bees in the wild and bring back honeycombs, so that was exciting. And we didn't have to buy wine or liquor. He made liquor, and my aunt made wine from China berries, muscadines, corn. I didn't have to ask for food because there was always plums, berries, nuts, something you could eat without asking. If you was hungry, you got it. We had so much food around us that we would eat the heart out of the watermelon, that's the middle, and we throw the rest to the chickens. And that's something.
Yawa eventually joined her mother in Knoxville, but returned to her family land with her husband, Obafemi, and their children in the 1980s, when the city life felt constrictive. Yawa and Obafemi raised 6 of their 9 children on the farm and off the grid, teaching them self-sufficiency and educating them at home.
I guess you would call me a radical. I was just, I'm not being in the box no more. I just got out of the box. I don't want to be in the box. I got outside of the box, crushed the box, set the box on fire. And I said, we're free, children. You're free. So they would be so far sometime, we wouldn't know where they was. But they would come back with different kind of nuts and berries and flowers and say, look what we found, Umi, look, mama, look. It was really rewarding watching them grow and having confidence in themselves. Or who they was as, you know, little people on the earth, growing up that way. If the lights don't come back on for 2 or 3 weeks, you know what to do. If you happen to be a place that you can identify, that is a pecan tree, this is a pear tree, that's a peach tree. The plant identification that where you can actually forage food.
Yawa returned to Tennessee and eventually ran a vegan catering business. But the family land in Alabama kept calling her, or actually, her Aunt Mahala kept appearing in her dreams.
My aunt kept coming to me, you know, like, I need you to do what you say you're going to do. And it was so real, you know. She appeared in these visions, like, I'm seeing you all, that made me sit up and be like, okay, I guess I need to get to Alabama.
So Yawa did come back. And she found comfort and care from her family, community, and the land.
It's like this. It's like somebody's rocking you and holding you. That's how I feel when I'm here. Even when I'm not doing nothing, I know that I'm doing something. Because I feel like I'm here and I'm honoring. It comes a time in your life, you have to sit still sometime.
Like Andrew Williams, Yawa believes that to thrive on the land, you have to listen to it.
You got
to
be in harmony. With the earth, because every place you plow up and you put a seed there, it don't mean that it's going to grow like that. One time I was plowing out there and I was planting all these seeds and they didn't come up. I said, oh, these seeds ain't no good. So I just tossed them. And where I tossed them, they came up. Yeah, I had beautiful watermelon patch this summer, but I got my biggest watermelon where I tossed the seed when I was eating it. And that's why I kind of am right now, just allowing the earth to show me this will do good here, this will do good there. Like them flowers coming up right there, I had them in a box that I was going to plant. I never got around to it. Then the box disintegrated. So I'm going to leave that plant there because that's where it done decided. And I feel like if I take it up, it might not grow back where I decide that it needs to grow.
Yawa shares this message in the classes she teaches, encouraging folks to listen to the land, work in concert with it, and honor what it produces, letting the natural flavors of vegetables and the healing properties of herbs shine through.
Everybody's so used to putting salt on their food that if you don't taste the salt, you say the food not good. You have no idea how that piece of broccoli tastes. You have no idea how you know, potatoes taste. I baked them sweet potatoes. I ain't put no sugar, no brown sugar, no. I said, eat the potato. So they was like, this potato, pretty good. I took rosemary because rosemary is a herb, especially for us as women, that when you're feeling anxious, you can just bruise it and smell it, and it'll just calm you down. Take peppermint, the same thing. Buy you some fresh peppermint. Make you some tea. Sniff the mint itself, chew it, drink the tea, or take orange peels, boil it in a pot, and it'll calm down your old house.
Someday, Yawa hopes to transform her land into a teaching farm and healing center.
One of the things I do want to be able to manifest on the land is a healing center. Like when people like yourself and Jackie, you're constantly working, just come and put your feet in some red clay. and just sit there, you know, and be.
Andrew Williams and Yawa Awolowo propose a model for the Black Belt's next era, one that centers the land and women leaders, one that requires listening, honoring, and rest, a future in which Black land ownership, cooperation, and care are again currency.
Gravy was reported and produced by Jackie Clay and Emily Blavos. Ms. Clay is the curator and executive director at the Coleman Center for the Arts in Sumter County, Alabama. Ms. Blavos is the executive director of the Alabama Folklife Association.
Gravy was mixed and edited by Matt Whitson, a video editor and audio engineer at Alabama Public Television.
Special thanks goes to Katie David Tynes and Adam Johnston.
We thank Wendell Patrick for Gravy's theme music, Jazar for our donor music.
Managing editor for Gravy and all other SFA media is Sarah Camp Milam, and she's sitting right next to me. Mary Beth Laster serves as our publisher. She's at the beach.
Visit us at southernfoodways.org to watch films, read your way through our event bibliographies, or listen to this podcast. And while you're there, become a member or make a donation. Your dollars fund our work and help us make more gravy.
I'm John T. Edge.
And I'm Melissa Hall.
Thanks for letting us pour some gravy in your ear.